Welcome, everyone, to the Ask the Anarchist podcast, an ongoing conversation concerning anarchy, its premises, stigmas, and common misunderstandings. This is your humble host, Joey, from the Libertalia Foundation. First of all, I'd like to thank everyone who came out today to support the show and for all those that are going to listen online at the archive. Last show, I forgot to mention that the music that you hear at the beginning and end of the podcast is by a band by the name of Cage the Elephant, and that song, the name of that song is In One Ear. So if you listen to the words, then you can see how they apply to the podcast and what we're trying to do. In the last podcast, we discussed the premises to a philosophy that encompasses anarchy as one of the components, or more correctly, as one of the conclusions. And while I was listening to the podcast, it left a looming question in my mind that I thought anyone listening may also share. And that question is, why do people need a philosophy in the first place? So I thought I'd begin and try to provide a brief answer to that question before introducing my guests and before opening the show up to the audience for any questions. So first off, we all have a philosophy regardless if we know it or not. And it's that philosophy or knowledge that we use to deal with the fundamental problems such as those connected with existence, values, reason, and the mind. And secondly, the need for a philosophy stems from a few of the premises mentioned in the first podcast, specifically that humans are conscious beings capable of rational thought, thus capable of acting. So naturally, humans require an area of study to assist with understanding their existence, the world around them, and how those two ideas come together. And lastly, philosophy is needed due to the conflict that arises due to the human condition, that humans act in their own self-interest of the individual in service of their needs, and that some of these resources required to meet those needs are scarce. Thus, philosophy assists in providing answers to how individuals should act and why. I know this is a short answer, but I wanted just to touch on it briefly before we got started today. And this may lead to many more questions than the answers that have been provided, but that's okay, because we're not here to answer everything in one or two podcasts. That's why this is an ongoing conversation. So now on to the show. I have here today with me my friend and fellow anarchist Joe from the Mises West Group. Joe's the treasurer for Mises West, and you may remember him from the debate that we did against a few socialist professors last year. It's now the infamous voluntarist versus socialist debate over on YouTube, and that's where the entire debate can be seen, and it's 27 parts, but don't let that scare you. They're not a long 27 parts. It was just broken down into those parts due to the topics as we went through it. So that's over at YouTube at Hot for Liberty. So go ahead and check it out. The last time I was over there, I think we were up to a whopping 3,000 votes or views, not votes. Actually, it did have 43 likes, but zero dislikes. So I don't know what was up with that, because there were a lot of socialists over there leaving comments, so I guess maybe the dislike button was turned off. I'm not sure. So anyways.
Well, they probably liked the socialists.
Yeah.
that's suspicious.
So Joe, before we get started, is there anything you want the audience or the online listeners to know about yourself?
Oh, well, I guess I could make a comment about the debate since we're on that topic. First off, when you watch it, it's always easier to critique something after it's done, and it's a lot harder to do something like that than it seems. You can sit back from your armchair and look at it and point out little mistakes here and there, but the preparation...
Mostly from you, because I couldn't find any critiques of myself, but I had a whole list.
Of course, preparing for that, I learned a lot and studied a lot more, I guess studied harder than I would have normally when you're just reading it sort of for your own education. It's almost like the test for your reading material. Also, I guess I'll mention a little bit about how I got into libertarianism, anarchism, whatever you want to call it. And it was basically through the whole Ron Paul, when he ran for office a couple years ago. Before that, I was in the military, and before that, I was in college, and before that, high school, and never really thought much about politics. What you learn back then is that you're a Republican, a Democrat, or crazy. And so, after I got out of the military, I had some time to reflect on a lot of stuff and started listening to, like, what Ron Paul had to say. And then ended up getting motivated enough to actually go out and meet some real people that were interested in this stuff. And actually, the first event I went to, I met Joey Hill, and he basically told me that he was an anarchist, and I was like, what the hell is that? Like, no, nah, that's not
crazy,
cool.
Right?
You're crazy, yeah. Yeah. Okay. And he basically said, well, if you're for minimal government, then the most minimal government would be no government. So logically, that makes sense. And I didn't really like that answer at the time, but it was sort of one of the first experiences I had to the idea that there should be no coercive government in the form that we have today. And it led me to other stuff like Wes Bertrand's Complete Liberty podcast and his book, and to Stefan Molyneux. I think he was the one that really like got me over my very last grasp of statism, yeah, or whatever it is.
Yeah, and it's like they say, there's no government like no government.
Exactly.
And you mentioned Wes and you mentioned Steph, and if you go over to the info page at the Ask the Anarchist podcast on Facebook, you'll see just one book by each of those authors I put down there is just I guess is if I was going to read something from them, that would be the book that I would start with. So they're over there with a few other authors and some book recommendations as well. So if you go to the Facebook page, go over to the info, and you can see all the premises that we established from the first podcast, and you can also see some book recommendations. And it's funny you mentioned Paul. I mean, Paul's, I call him the gateway drug to liberty. Just like Ayn Rand of the generation before was kind of the gateway drug, Paul has been the gateway drug for a lot of individuals today. But that's what it is. He's the gateway drug.
Yep.
So at some point, you got to get beyond the gateway drug and try new things.
Hard things.
Experiment a little bit. Try the hard stuff.
Mainline.
because as I mentioned in the last podcast, being an anarchist, it ain't easy. Because there's one thing that Republicans, Democrats, and liberals and conservatives can all agree, and that's that the anarchists are wrong. So it is very difficult.
Damn crazy bomb throwers.
Yeah, there you go. Well, thanks for that, Joe. One last thing I want to take care of before we turn it over to the audience, and hopefully they have some questions. I wanted to mention one comment from the Facebook page. And that comment was for the very first podcast that we did on the premises, and it was from Paul H. And he commented that after listening to the premise podcast, that he now has to, and I'm doing a little quote thing, seriously question his parenting philosophy. And when he left that there and I read it, it kind of reinforced what I was thinking after I listened to the podcast as well, is that I was talking about the philosophy just in the context of anarchy, but I was thinking, well, if it can be, it's anarchy is a conclusion, like I said. Therefore, Paul got that, and I was left with the same thing, is that, you know, and that's why I wanted to talk about applying the philosophy to everything, and I'm really glad that he got that, because, you know, kids are individuals too. Kids aren't property of their parents, just as parents aren't property to other individuals in society, including, you know, those guys in government. So, you know, since kids are individuals, they should be free from domination, manipulation, coercion, and most importantly, physical and mental harm from their parents or anyone else. So I'm glad that he got that from that first podcast and made that connection, because, you know, I gave up a long time ago trying to change the world. So all I do is just have conversations with people, and wherever they lead, they lead. And if I can have a conversation with just one person, which I've already done, who's going to take a hard look at himself and his relationship that he has between his kids, then that's great. Then I've already won, and you know, you can leave all the bad comments about me over on Facebook or wherever else that you want to, because I've already won a battle. I've already won a war.
How about the bathroom wall?
Yeah, or the bathroom wall, as our fans here at the cafe are yelling out. So you have anything to add to that, Joe?
Not really. The only thing that comes to mind is School Sucks podcast, which is all about education and that kind of thing. And before getting into that podcast, it's kind of old now, maybe. I mean, he has new stuff all the time, but when it first started about a year ago, I didn't have much of a background on education and as far as like the system and what alternatives are out there and what could be better. And eventually getting into that podcast, it motivated me to join this startup Sudbury School in San Diego. And Sudbury is not, it's not like, they're not anarchists, it's not like a it's not perfect, but the general idea is self-education or self-guided education, where the kids basically just study what they want to study.
Yeah, learner-driven.
Exactly. Yeah. There's no. It's not like the current system where they. There's some authoritarian, basically at the front of the classroom, telling you what you need to know.
You know, and it's funny, we're sitting here talking about, or ironic, I guess I should say, is that there's a nonviolent communication meetup going on behind us, and over on the info page as well is Marshall Rosenberg and his book on nonviolent communication, and that's one of those things, if you read that, he also has a parenting book as well that really helps parents, deal with the relationships and stuff that they have with their kids. So that's another good book for anyone that's interested in really changing up the way that they look at their children and the way their children look at them. So, with that being said, I'm looking out here at all these lovely faces, and it's kind of over in Patricia's area, not the rest of you. So, who's got something? Any questions? Yep.
So tell me, how did you feel, Joe and Joey, after that debate with the socialists there?
You want to take that one, Joe? A physicist and a
sociology professor?
Yeah, I think the main thing I felt after it was sort of self-critical, and that I wish I could have explained things better. And actually, the biggest thing was I wish we could have nailed them better. Like, there were so many things they were so, like, I guess, fishy about. Like, they wouldn't admit that they were violating the non-aggression principle, and they were trying to basically say everything's force. Like, they're trying to say it's coercion if a child's born into poverty, that's coercion. Yeah. But they're totally manipulating the term and sort of dodging the point we're trying to say, that no, the coercion is where, you know, you're advocating this central authority that can forcibly take the property of some people,
right,
and call it legitimate, even if it's using force, and there's no agreement behind it.
Right. If I remember correctly, I did ask them. I don't remember if I asked both of them. It was the physics professor that responded when I asked if he was willing to force his political philosophy on me, and he did make that admission.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
He just kind of, you know, set it real low. I don't even know if the camera picked it up or not. And of course, the sociologist professor wasn't going anywhere near that admission. You know, that they had said that. Yeah, we're. You know,
what was interesting is at the end of their debate, I think it was in the last segment, the sociology professor actually said, and this just stripped him naked on the camera, because he actually said, when you hit him point blank and said, is there any amount of leeway we have in running our own lives? And he actually deigned to say to you, well, we would allow you to have your own choices in a few areas of personal relationships and things like that. And I just thought, oh, really?
Thanks.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny, I was reading one of the, I went over there just to see how many views were there so I could put it in at the beginning of this, and I started reading through the thread, and that was like one of the things that, you know, was on the comments there that was clearly pointed out. So yeah, I mean, it was a very interesting debate. I'm glad we did it, and like Joe said,
you
can always go back and take a look at yourself and say, wow, you know, I wish I'd have picked another debate partner or something.
What's the link for that? What would someone Google to get that, too?
I went over to YouTube, and I typed in Joey Hill debate, and that's how I found it.
But you could also just go to Hot for Liberty account. They have it.
Yeah, that's sometimes good, yeah. I had trouble finding it through Hot for Liberty for some reason, but that's Hot for Liberty, F-O-R, and it's all one word, so maybe that was the issue that I was having. And he posted some other videos when one of the members of the Ayn Rand Institute come down, and some voluntarists went over to listen to him speak, and had posed some questions to him about anarchy. And you could watch him stumble through, because I think he's aware that the contradiction exists, but they just don't know how to handle it.
So they go to Hot for Liberty, one word for that one?
Hot for Liberty, yeah.
And then they look for the anarchist socialist non-debate. Gotcha.
Yeah. And also, I mean, if you look at the metaphysics and epistemology surrounding this philosophy, it's almost objectivist. Rand had a lot to do with it. but it's we're taking their metaphysics and their epistemology and applying it differently and arriving at the full conclusion. And it's that leap that they're unable to take, and I don't know if it's because she's the high priestess of objectivism, and you know you could get excommunicated.
She's the bitch queen of philosophy.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you remember, Craig asked that question to the socialists. You know, would you force your forcing these part of your program?
I do.
Or would you have cops in your house for your program?
Yeah, I remember that. Not, you know, and there was I don't know if anybody could hear that, but Andrew was pointing out during the debate that the socialists said that they would be willing to send their police force over to your home to, you know, to expropriate funding and funds and stuff for to fund their coercive government. And I, you know, there was one point in the debate where I said, "Hey, listen, in the political world that I'm talking about, you can have your socialist community. You can go over wherever you want, get with all your friends, and have your little thing. But in your world, I can't have what I want. So you're saying that I can't have something. That, you know, that's force." And I remember this one lady that was sitting in the front that would cringe. She could barely sit in her seat whenever we said anything. And I was like, was that lady so dominated and controlled and abused as a child that she just wants to dominate and manipulate and coerce others? Is that her problem? Because she just couldn't get over the, you know, that fact.
That might be part of it. I don't know how, like, when you get with older people, like these guys were sort of older. Mike Benoit, we talked about him. And it's not just like that age
has
to do with
it. Word, didn't you?
But you just kind of get set in your ways. Some people do. And I feel like with the Voluntarist debate with our friend Mike, they just, you know, they have their ideas set. They know that they're right, and they know that they're like good or and everything that opposes it is wrong or bad. And it you get to a point where you realize like you can't convince these people. Like, you're not going to be able to convince those people. It's younger people. Or even maybe young at heart.
Right.
Or open-minded, really, is the main.
Yeah, and that's a good point. Sure. I mean, one thing is, I would like to let everybody know, I'm not here trying to convince anybody of anything. This is just a conversation. You can listen to it. You can ignore it. You can do whatever. Because at the end of the day, that's what you're going to do, and so be it. As long as you're not trying to, you know, like from the debate, I remember when a guy was talking about the baklava or whatever, and I said he was trying to continuously shove it down my throat. So as long as you're not trying to, you know, shove that stuff against my will down my throat, I don't really care what you do. But you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, individuals like that have not only have an emotional investment in that philosophy that they're unable to get over, but they also have a time investment in it as well. And in some cases, they also have a money investment, where they've spent, you know, making donations to political parties, to political candidates, and all that thrown together, they just can't get over the hump into a different philosophy. You know, I've had an individual that I work with, and he's flat out told me that I'm too old to change. I agree with everything that you're saying, but I'm too old to change, and if I did change, or if the world changed to your view, then I may lose retirement, my pension from the military, that he may lose his Social Security, that he may lose these things. And I understand that. I mean, I think there's ways that those types of things can be funded if government would disappear, that would be voluntary and could actually work, which we could get in to at a later show. But I think, you know, that's there. And I commented on a friend of mine's Facebook page the other day who, we, for those of you who don't know, we had a little, I guess it was preemptive, or we did it a little too soon, had a little shindig to celebrate the shutdown of the federal government on Friday, which was actually just an excuse for us to get together and have a couple beers. But anyways, a friend of mine had posted, who's a retired Marine, and he posted on his Facebook page that he'd be willing to give up his retirement. He'd be willing to give up his health care. He'd be willing to give up the job that he has right now supporting the military to get rid of the government. He would absolutely be willing to do all that. And, you know, I've posted over there in response is like, that's a courageous stance, because a lot of individuals had turned into entitlement kings and welfare queens, and they're just, you know, they said, well, you know, I had money stolen from me my whole life, and and now you're telling me that I'm on the benefit end of it now, and you don't want me to have that. And I say, well, that's not about me not wanting you to have something. It's that I don't support theft and redistribution. That's what this is about. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, two quick questions. One of them is, do you think one of the problems that people have in understanding anarchy is that the language has been so corrupted that, just as this woman who recoiled in your audience during your debate when you talked about the coercion and violence, she could not simply face up to what she really was all about, because you get liars like FDR talking about four freedoms. They corrupted the use of the word freedom to shoehorn in their philosophy. So she didn't like the fact that you were calling a spade and saying she's coercing. And the second one is, do you think that these people, like this person, this Marine who would finally give up his pension, do you think they are just lacking the creative ability to realize that if the government wasn't shutting everybody down with it squatting over us like we are some toilet for the government, that if they let things go free, the world would be such a better place that they can't even imagine how wonderful it would be. If the government had been in control of computers instead of the market, we would all be sitting there with abacus at this point.
Yeah, you want to take the first one, Joe? And it was the lady that
that lady and the corruption of language, and they don't like it when you actually tell them, no, you're the ones who don't like diversity. You're the ones who can't tolerate freedom among you while we tolerate your collectivism among us.
Oh, I pretty much agree with that, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I do too. I think it goes back to not only that emotional investment and everything, back to the perversion, the perversions that you're talking about in language. And also, I mean, we were talking on the way over here. You're telling me a story about your parakeet and Alex, and I said, birds of a feather, flock together. What's the same thing? I mean, these individuals, the relationships that they have and the gangs that they run with support their philosophy, and probably their family does too. So you go against that, then you're going against your gang. So then you're going to be ostracized from your gang, and nobody wants that. And that kind of reminds me, I was down at OG's having a pint with a friend of mine, with actually Robbie from the first podcast, and this gentleman sat up, bellied up to the bar beside of us, and something came on the TV screen on the news, and he made a comment. And Robbie and I just looked at each other and kind of shook our heads, and I kind of tried to shrug it off, and then he made a second comment, and I was like, well, I can't do it, I don't have that discipline. So I turned around and engaged in a conversation with him. And so come to find out, the guy was friends with Duncan Hunter, the younger one, which I found ironic because most of you know that I worked on a Mike Benoit's campaign who ran as a libertarian against Duncan Hunter Jr. So we had this conversation with him, and the guy, he said, you know what? I've sat here for the last 30 or 45 minutes and tried to have a logical and reasonable debate and conversation, argument with you guys, and every time I think I come up with something that shoots you down, then I can't. I just can't do it. So he made the admission that I 100% now agree with everything that you're saying. But he said, at the end of the day, I'm never going to see you two again. He said, when I leave here, I got to go deal with my friends like Duncan Hunter and these other guys, and they don't believe that way. So if I start bringing these things up, then it's going to cause conflict in the relationship with the other statist that I have in my life. So therefore, I'm just going to, kind of shove this under the carpet and go on about my business. And I said, well, that's all fine and dandy. When you came through that door, you had an excuse because you didn't know. I said, after sitting here for about 30, 45 minutes, you know now. So my hopes are that at night, maybe you're laying there, you can't sleep, or you're on a long drive and your mind's wandering, that it wanders back to this conversation and that you realize that you're living a lie and a contradiction, and you're doing it on purpose and you know about it and you're doing it consciously. So,
how about you, Joseph? What about you? You seem to have influenced people just by holding your views, and they seem to understand. I talked to your father. I think he gets it, and some of your roommates get it, and they weren't born into this.
Yeah, well, I mean, I just talk to people and try to convince them, I guess, especially people like that are friends of mine or close to me. But I don't know, maybe it's my strategy, or maybe I'm just lucky and get people that are open to it already. And
look, yeah, charm and personality.
Drinking while you're gonna throw out the A word to someone that's not already in the know is probably not a bad idea.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I do. Looks, charm, and personality is how I do it.
Yeah.
I mean, but, as you guys can see and probably tell.
But it depends. I think the person receiving the message, where they're coming from, depends or affects how successful you're going to be or not. Because, like, my dad's basically, you know, agrees with almost all the libertarian stuff. And so he's sort of not over a couple humps like the military thing. And I just keep working on him, basically. I'll send him articles from Mises if I see him that are relevant to, like, his sticking points, and kind of do the same thing with other friends of mine.
You know, it's funny you mention that, because it isn't a one-shot, one-kill to throw out a military term on the argument. You really have to fill up the person, not physically, so Joe, keep your hands to yourself, but you really have to fill up the person and see what's their one thing or two things that they have issues getting over. But so often they move so fast that you can't get you can't get the punctuation mark on the end of something before they're moving on to something else. And that's the case of the guy I was talking about that had issues with his pension and his Social Security and everything. It's like he moved so fast and was going off in so many directions. It's like, well, wait a minute, let's come to a conclusion on one thing before we move on to something else. So it's like, I don't have to, we're not going to settle everything right here, but let's at least get somewhere.
It sounds like they almost want to escape into another challenge so they don't have to face up to the fact that you just answered their last question.
Yeah.
And they don't want to acknowledge that, and they want to move on to new territory.
Right. And you had a second question. I don't remember what it was.
I just sometimes wonder about how impoverished our lives are of the lack of freedom we have. The number of poor people, because the government squats over our lives in so many horrible ways.
Right. And it's funny you mention that, because over on the San Diego Austrians Facebook page, someone posted a chart on there that shows the poverty line since the war on poverty. So it was this huge decline on poverty up until the war on poverty, and I'm doing the little quotes things for those of you who can't see, and then poverty started rising. So it's been kind of stayed steady and risen from that point when the war on poverty started, but it's never dipped down. It never continued to go down past the beginning point for the war on poverty, but it was on a pretty steep decline up until the war on poverty was started.
Why do you think that people who are so enamored of the war on poverty are so stuck on it in spite of the evidence that they're actually hurting poor people?
Well, and here's what I think it is. I think that a lot of people, they have government and use government as to act on their behalf. So instead of going out myself and doing something to help poor people, like, you know, give donations or go down and work at a soup kitchen on the holidays, as my family's done before, to help out, it's now they can say, well, the government has a war on poverty, so therefore it's acting for poverty on my behalf. So it relieves me of having to do anything myself. So I think that's what a lot of people look to government for, is since they think that these people actually represent them, which they don't, because as we know from the action axiom, people act in their own self-interest.
So it's pretty narcissistic, these people who think that by delegating this thing to a failing program,
right,
which actually hurts people, because they've said the magic words, I care, they don't care about the results, because it's all about them and their feelings about themselves.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think part of this also, though, goes back to your initial education about, you know, how do you solve the problems like poverty? Well, you have, you know, FDR got us on track to solve that with different kinds of welfare
Social
or whatever.
Security.
I might be wrong. Maybe it wasn't FDR.
Social Security.
Yeah, there was a lot of...
He was Social Security.
Yeah, there was a lot of FDR programs to get people to work, but what, you know, if you go back and you ask any economist who wants to be honest about it, all he was doing was stealing from the private industry putting it into a government industry and saying, okay, well, I stole a job from private industry and I've created a government one. So it wasn't really creating anything. It was just redistributing where the jobs and where the money was going.
But I think when people first learn this, it's in school, and they basically learn, like, well, there's Democrats and the Republicans, and there's poor people, and Democrats want to tax a little bit of the rich people a little more to help these poor people, because that's how you help poor people. You take from the rich and give to the less rich. But they don't go into, like, underlying reasons and underlying causes of what that welfare actually does. And in a term, you could say that incentivizes poverty, because you're going to be paid to be, like, under a certain income, so it's going to incentivize more people to be that way. I mean, I could sort of relate to my own experience of being on unemployment, where I don't think I'd ever do it again, just because, like, you don't have a reason to really get off of it. Like,
it's addictive.
Yeah, I mean, it's free money, and you could work and maybe earn a little bit more, but then you would have done all that work when actually you could have just, you know, enjoyed all that time and gotten paid a little bit less.
You had something, JP. What was it?
Well, it seemed like this whole discussion was kind of leading into, the philosophical debate about individualism versus collectivism, I tend to lean more towards individualism, but, you know, I do kind of see some of the concern that some maybe more liberal-minded people would have that you know, there's a sort of, like, extreme individualism in that, you know, everyone is just individuals, and then ultimately there is no, like, social system, or that there is no sort of, that relationships play less of a part in their lives, and I think that's important. So that all ultimately comes back to, like, a concept like self-esteem. Like, I was just thinking of a conversation that I had with a friend of mine on Facebook about health, and how the poor typically have, you know, a lot more problems with health. And my argument was that, you know, beyond the fact that, you know, they're not getting enough resources, and that there's, you know, corporate dominance in food production, and, you know, government subsidization of you know, industries, I thought that a more crucial problem, and I think this is what Joe was touching on, was self-esteem, is that, you know, just something else other than, you know, what the numbers say about poverty. Right. Like, why are the poor poor? And my friends seem to think that my comments about self-esteem were not scientific enough. They weren't relevant to the discussion about why people are poor. He said that, you know, now let me introduce some real evidence, and he started, you know, spewing facts at me. And so I think this concept is important. What do you think about individualism and collectivism? What do you think about self-esteem? You know, like, how does that play into anarchism?
Right. You know, you're talking about that. You know, poverty is now a choice instead of a condition. And, you know, I think that's in simple terms how to put it. But you're absolutely right. And because it is now a choice, and as Joe was saying, when he was on unemployment, that he had less of an incentive to get off unemployment. So now, since poverty can be a choice instead of a condition, then that incentive is out there to stay on it. So in that case, when you look at that incentive and you start taking it over to the psychological side and start talking about self-esteem and those other types of things, you're like, what type of person would take that incentive to stay poor make the choice to stay in that condition? What type of person would do that, and why? So that's when you start looking at the self-esteem issue. Joe was on unemployment, but he got off of it because he has self-esteem, and he knew that he didn't want to be there. That he wanted to, you know, go out and be a producer in the market and provide better for himself, and also, you know, add some value.
No, I actually just ran out.
I disagree with that analysis that poverty is essentially a choice. I mean, like, there is that component that, you know, welfare can be addictive and things like that, but there are lots of other factors, lots of other actions that governments take that forcibly make people poor. You know, you see that in fiat currencies, you see that in the emergence of privileged corporations.
Oh, how about minimum wage laws? That's a big one.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
Because another thing with, like, you know, when someone goes on
unemployment. Explain how that works, Joe.
Especially if someone's on unemployment for, like, over a year or 2 years, they just become less hireable because you don't really have, like, a track record. You always want, like, someone with a track record to have more confidence in, like, you know, what they're going to do for you.
How does the minimum wage law keep people from the minimum wage law?
It's basically like getting your foot in the door, essentially. A lot of people, if they don't have any skills, then it's really hard to get an initial job. Whereas if the minimum wage law was lower, then a lot of people could get that initial job better and get productive skills quicker to where they would then be worth more to an employer.
Yeah, it keeps some people out of the market. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, it tells you even the wage law or the laws against kids being able to work as well.
Yeah.
So it's the government telling you that a kid has nothing to add to the market, or their labor is worth less than everyone else's. I mean, that's what the message really is.
Yeah, that's another fun topic if you, like, get into some... There's some people that in Mises that talk about, like, child labor and that kind of thing, and how basically the child labor problem was cured by the free market, because people don't really want their kids to work. But if you look at, like, a poor third world country, like, the kids have to work because otherwise the family wouldn't have enough money to make enough to feed themselves.
It's like they don't have the luxury of protecting their children from
work. Right, yeah. So now you have the United States where, you know, the result is buildup of capital and wealth to where the kids don't need to work, and we maybe abolished, you know, 90% of child labor, and then the government came in and abolished the last 10% and took credit for everything.
Yeah.
So
and you know, back to my poverty being a choice and not a condition. Yeah, you get put into condition, but if it was just a condition, you'd have to lift yourself out of it. So by that I mean that you can choose to be poor and receive welfare payments and stay. That's what I meant from it.
Well, I mean there is a lot of I think it's what I find most interesting is that is the aspect of responsibility in all of these issues. Like how is it that we could or some people could simultaneously like advocate all these, you know, good, all this public policy and behind a good intent or advocate public policy based on good intentions, but at the same time it have like disastrous effects and it just seems like it just can't be that simple. Well, that analysis of public policy is ultimately, you know, motivated by the best of intentions.
Yeah, and that's my thesis for my degree was kind of based on that. I didn't really have much of a choice of what to write on, but it was called the Hell's Highways Are Paved with Good Intentions, The Truth Behind the Americans with Disability Act. And so that, you know, this is a different subject, and I'm not going to go off on that tangent, but it falls into the same thing. I mean, you could put that and then put any type of government program after that. What were you going to say, Jeff?
Well, I was having a train of thought. Maybe I can explain it. Hopefully I can explain it well, but the government seems to take over things that people care about, that have a lot of interest in, like education, like helping, you know, poor people or old people. Like, people do like to know that they're taken care of. People like education. So the government takes it over. They do it their way, which is usually not a good way, but then they claim that, well, we're the one-stop shop for education, so if you don't support us, you don't support education. But they know that, well, it's not that they is some conspiracy, but everyone knows that education's important.
It's too important for the government to be involved.
Exactly. So you know, that's where the train of thought ended. I hope whatever I said made sense.
And I want to go back, you know, to Larry's initial question too, about government keeping, or as government gets bigger, then you're really
squatting was
no.
The word
what's
I
it? Heard. What's it called? Your living standards. Yeah, yeah. I had a brain fart as well. Your standard living. There you go. So I'm sure there's probably some graph out there that shows as the Leviathan gets bigger, known as government, that standards of living start to go down. And kind of part of that I'd like to tie in is that when we anarchists talk about no government, it immediately, all these individuals start thinking, well, if there's no government, then you have no roads, you have no education, you have none of this, and you must be against the poor, and you must be against all this. And it's like, whoa, I didn't say any of that. And those are other common misconceptions that are out there, that because I don't support one thing, that I'm against all these other things. And that's absolutely not true.
Sorry to interrupt, but you made a claim that as government gets bigger and takes over more stuff, living standards go down, but I think if you look at reality, or not reality, but the history, you don't actually see that because I think technology kind of overcompensates for anything the government does. Because, I mean, I was asked a question once, and I was talking about how the U.S. government used to be smaller and got worse. And the question was, well, if you could be born in any other decade, what would it be? And I said, well, I'd have to pick now because we've got so much more.
Yeah.
The living standards so much higher because of technology, not because of the government.
It's in spite of the government.
In spite of the government, right. We have the internet.
Yeah, you're not allowed back on the show. You're not supposed to be disagreeing.
All what about stuff. Those who say that the internet was a government creation?
Yeah.
Without the government, you wouldn't have the most important...
Remember that 21st. Lecture we gave on Gutenberg?
The government. You know, I'm sitting here thinking about it. Maybe the standard of living wasn't the best analogy. Maybe a better analogy is government gets bigger or civil liberties.
But there's a good answer.
I think that's
JP.
A necessary correlation.
Yeah.
Because nothing happened with the internet as long as the government was in control of it. It was only when it was turned over to the market, when they abandoned their lockjaw on it, that it took off and became actually something useful. And ironically, it was sex that sold the early internet into what it is. There's a question I have about this poverty. I think this is a fascinating thing. What do you think is the psychology, and think about it, what do you think the psychology is behind these people that believe in big government as a cure to poverty? Because you brought up that great chart, Joey, about how the poverty rate was dropping in the United States until 1964-65, when the Great Society program started. And since then, it's been basically leveled. In other words, the progress against poverty stopped the minute politics got involved in curing poverty. What do you think is the psychology behind these people who keep insisting that we have more and more of something that clearly isn't working and is destroying black families? Because we were talking
about poor
people in jobs.
Well, I think I've actually gotten this answer before.
And when I was teaching in Detroit, I was there when there was already one generation of kids who had never known anyone that worked. Now we're in the third generation of people from the Great Society program. They have not known anyone in their family that worked, and they literally are stuck in that mindset. Do you think that this horrible situation should be somehow revisited on all these advocates of poverty? Because they're not living with what they've created. What do you think is going on in
their head?
Think
I got an answer to this once before when I probably got in a debate online or something like that. And I think the answer is that welfare that helps the poverty, the goal is not to lower poverty, but it's to reduce suffering for people that already are in poverty. I believe that is an answer that I got at some point. I don't think it's a very good one because it's not helping them. They basically admit they're not helping the problem.
Though they're creating more poverty, they're just happy that it's putting a floor under it, even though they're creating more of it all the time.
Well, I think it's the same psychology that you look at anyone that's on some sort of welfare. Because there's corporate welfare, there's military welfare, there's government employee welfare, there's poverty welfare, there's all those different things. And if you advocate getting rid of government, which they think then their welfare payments go away, they have problems with that. So I think part of it is self-preservation is part of that. And a lot of and it's going to be different in a sense for somebody who's on corporate welfare than somebody that's actually on welfare payments. But I think it's they start getting that sense of entitlement.
You just touched the third rail, Joey. You were talking about military welfare. We live in San Diego. I thought the military is just an example of all the best of America. How could it possibly be that there's socialism in the Army? Is it really true?
The Army is socialist.
Oh, it's
very.
And I can
how.
Tell you, I was in the Marines for 10 years. I can absolutely tell you firsthand experience that the military is a socialist organization, and it's established like that. It's made the whole environment is a socialist environment.
Totally.
Yeah.
You mean the pay is instigated on how much more dependent they become?
Yeah. You hit on something too. That's why they have pay bonuses. So during this whole war on terror and these wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, in order to keep certain people around that they need, they offer incentive bonuses That's where the whole ribbons and medals stuff came from. It's providing rewards to people to keep them around, to keep them engaged in whatever.
Is it true they get paid more to have if they're married or have kids?
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. And
that's basically an example of the government incentivizing people to.
Yeah, that's another big government program that basically just incentivizes people to get married. So in a sense, you could call it a government-subsidized, prostitution. You know, if you're a lonely military guy and you want a lady to be around, you're basically paid to have any girl you want to stay over.
It's funny you mention that. When I was stationed at Camp Lejeune in my early years in the Marine Corps, my roommate and I and a couple other guys, we used to joke around about starting up a pen pal relationship with some woman in jail. And then, so she's in jail, we start a relationship, then we can marry them. So now we get married to a woman in jail, we can live out in town while they're and get the money while they're still in jail.
Is that what the military does?
Well, no, I can't see. I can only speak for it was more of a tongue-in-cheek type of thing, but it is an incentive for people to get married.
Yeah.
I mean, living in a barracks is kind of dismal anyways. I mean, if you've ever lived in government housing or near government housing or been in government housing, the barracks is just an extension of that.
Yeah, so the military promotes Marxism, is what you're saying.
I think I should explain something real quick that we didn't totally explain about how this incentive works to get married. And it mainly only applies to low-ranking enlisted people like E1 through E4 or so. Basically, you have your base pay in the military, and then you have all of these allowances on top of it. And a huge allowance is called a housing allowance, and it's tax-free. It's $1,000 to $1,500 per month tax-free. And so these lower-ranking guys do not get that at all. So if they get married, then they all of a sudden get this allowance, which gives them about a 50% bonus to their pay. So that's why it's not just like a small incentive like $100 a month. It's
that's
like
social engineering. How come I don't hear any conservatives shrieking?
But of course they say it's fair. They say if you're married, you have a family, you need more money.
Oh my God.
Very socialist.
Very Marxist.
And you get paid more for how many kids you have. You get paid more just for how many years you've been in. You get paid more automatically.
Exactly. They get away with that kid thing. You don't get paid. You don't get a bump up anymore for the children you have, but you used to. The more kids you have, the more money you got.
So they save that for ADC.
Yeah, there you have another incentive to go out and keep having children, but they did away with that because of the abuse that was taking place.
Okay, I think you might be right, but I just thought of something else. I think this is another scam similar to the getting married one, but I think if you adopt a kid or you have a kid, you also get that housing allowance too.
Yeah, you can be a geographical bachelor or something to that extent, to where if you had a child and you got divorced, then you could still live out in town because you previously had a child, even if they have custody of the child. So there's a bunch of legality things that are in there as well.
Yeah. There's a trend that hasn't hit the mainstream media yet that in the reserve forces, such as the National Guard, Army Reserve, Air Force Reserve, etc., the government is not allowing people to resign. I know people who have put in their letters of resignation, and these have been delayed by paperwork for 3 or 4 years, and they just can't resign from these so-called one weekend a month, where somebody signs up for 1 weekend a month, they end up over in Afghanistan or Iraq for a whole year.
Are you talking about stop loss?
Well, they whatever they call it, it's basically it's a reverse draft, where when I was in high school, we had a draft. They just inducted us into the military. Now they don't directly induct you into the military, but once you get into the military, at least for the reserve and the guard, it's almost impossible to get out now because there's people that are in the military violating all kinds of standards like weight, dress, and they're just being ignored because they need the bodies, and nobody wants to go in the reserve nobody wants to be in the reserve or the guard.
Yeah, it's a little different on the officer and enlisted side. The officers have their commission, and they can, depending on what your initial job is, how much money you got, maybe you got some money to go to school from the military, maybe you're in a specific job where it requires 3 years of of training, then you may have a 6-year commitment or something like that. Then after that, you can resign your commission. On the enlisted side, you have a contract that you sign. And if you go into active duty, it's an 8-year commitment. So you have 4 years active duty and 4 years inactive. And in those 4 years inactive, you can be called up at any time back to active duty. So when I don't know how well recruiters actually, and I'm not defending the system or anyone, I'm just kind of explaining it, that if you sign up for the military as an enlisted person, you have an 8-year commitment. So what ends up happening is these guys do their 4 years and they decide that it's not what they want to do anymore. They go to school, they go get a job, and next thing you know, you get a phone call or a sheet of paper telling you've been reactivated. So I think the reserves and National Guard is similar. You sign up for a certain amount of time, and then you're able to get off of it at some point, but it's all being extended. They call it stop loss.
Well, I have a friend that something like this happened to. He was in the Army for, I think, 4 or 5 years, and then got out, and he thought he was totally out, but he was actually in the IRR, got recalled about a year later and had to do a whole nother deployment after he was like a civilian for a year and thought he was totally done. They called his ass back, and he was really pissed about that.
You mean the government actually lied about something?
Well, you know, it's probably in the fine print of your contract.
And again, I'm not going to defend the government, but it is in the contract. But of course, as a recruiter's a salesman. So how often do salesmen tell you the fine print? Oh, by the way, you got this other 4 years of your life to where we can give you a phone call or send the MPs to come drag your sorry ass back to a base. And I remember when I got out to San Diego in January of 2003, and I was going through the gate over to Miramar, there was three guys there that I served with in Okinawa that got out. But they had both been recalled, and they weren't MPs, but they were made MP augments, and they were sticking them at the entrances to the gate, like two guys. So I was like, holy crap, I never thought I'd see you guys again, and here you both are, and they both got recalled.
So. Do you think that's why so many anarchists are coming out of the military? I mean, we live in the armpit of the military here in San Diego. And yet there's so many anarchists that are formerly in the military. What do you think's driving that?
You know, I don't know. I look at our group that meets here at the Cafe Libertalia for various things. From Mises West, they're part of the Libertalia Foundation. They do tax protests and all different kinds of things. And you look, and I think over half of them are former military. So I don't know if it's because going into the military, you get that strong injection of socialism and government controlling and ruling your entire life, that when you get out and you say, I saw the worst of it. I just don't want it anymore. And then, you know, having been to Iraq, you know, a few times myself, I've firsthand seen the horrors of wars. And I kind of looked at it and said, you know what, if this was happening in a neighborhood near me and my daughter or my family got hurt because of something like this, I'm holding people accountable for that. And I don't care who they are. So that was the other part, you know, for me anyways. But so I think that's how I got there. And it's funny that you mention that, because my introduction to libertarianism actually came from my boss in the military. We were having he was in school and he was doing a paper on the drug war. And I kind of had some issues with the libertarian things that were in his paper. So we had a pretty good debate on it. And I was like, oh, wow, he kind of changed my mind on the whole thing. And so I asked him, he's like, well, I'm a libertarian. He's a big L libertarian, you know, subscribes to the Libertarian Party. So on my downtime, I was over there, started doing some research on libertarianism and everything. And I could see that he wasn't taking libertarianism to its logical conclusion. He was stuck. And his sticking point was that libertarians don't see the threat of Al-Qaeda, and until they do, he can't get over the hump. But I won't get all into that. I'll just tell you that I saw the inconsistencies and the contradictions in what he was saying. But since I noticed them, I was like, well, I like this libertarianism. I agree with this. And it's about finding a philosophy that's consistent and free from contradictions. That's an actual philosophy. So I told him, I said, Ray, I've been looking at this and this libertarianism, and what I'm doing now is not consistent with libertarianism, so this is it for me. When I get back, I'm getting out. And that's what I did. I got back from Iraq and I got out of the Marine Corps.
I think that's awfully rich that somebody in the military would complain about the threat of Al-Qaeda since the CIA created Al-Qaeda.
Another thing with the whole thing about how a lot of us are military, I think a lot of non-military type of people out there they like romanticize about the military, like they're these protectors and they hold them on a pedestal, and they reminisce about, you know, World War II, the GIs saved us from horrible things that the Nazis or the Japanese wanted to do. But people that actually go into the military, especially today, see that it's not that. It's more offensive than defensive, and there's so much just like crap and BS the military does. It's a waste of money, a waste of time, a waste of life. Whereas people that sit back and romanticize about it but never experience it, may be less inclined to say, hey, this whole military thing is like a bad thing.
So you mean,
and maybe
those
the government behind it is too.
Those commercials showing the square-jawed youngster couldn't possibly be related to reality.
Well, you know, there's something else I want to point out too, is that I don't know the exact ratio. I think it's maybe 3 or 4 to 1. There's 3 to 4 individuals supporting the actual every one individual that actually participates in war. So you're talking about a great portion of the military. They just go over and they sit on this well-protected base where they have internet and anything you could possibly want. Some of them, I actually heard infantry units from Pendleton say that they were living better in Iraq and Afghanistan. Well, I don't know about Afghanistan, but Iraq, than what they were up at Camp Pendleton.
They certainly get paid a lot.
And plus, they're getting all this. They're getting money for being in a war zone.
Thank God, tax-free.
Everything's tax-free.
So
when you're
my point is that most people in the military never get shot at, or never see a dead body, or never have to deal with the psychological blowback from war because they're sitting in these cushioned bases. And it's these, you know, it's a small fraction of the military that actually has to pull a trigger and has to live with that psychological blowback from taking of someone else's life.
And the government wouldn't exploit that myth about all of these brave military people, would it? I mean, the fact that most of them are sitting behind a desk, they wouldn't try and project them all as heroes, now would they?
Heroes with problems. That's what they that's what they project them as. And they do. They legitimately have problems due to the psychological blowback of taking someone else's life. I mean, that's not the human condition. You know, there's billions of people in the world having trillions of peaceful interactions every second. You know, we're in this room, we've been in this room for well over an hour now, and no one's threatened anyone else's life. To me, that's the human condition, not this war. Because if it was that way, you wouldn't have to send young to lie to kids, manipulate them, coerce them throughout their entire adolescence in public schools, and then send them to a conditioning camp to be conditioned on taking another person's life. If human nature was to be mean and hurt other people, then you wouldn't have to condition people to do
boot
that.
Camp.
No.
Joseph, how long did it take for you to kind of see through the hype on and the myth about what they built the military up? Like, when did you start seeing that it was not what they said it was?
Well, like I said in like my introduction, I didn't really like fully come to like anarchy as a conclusion until after I got out of the military and I got in like the Ron Paul stuff and that kind of thing. But when I was in, I definitely remember having the idea that like a lot of money was wasted. I mean, my degree is accounting, and so when I was in, I would always keep like costs in mind, and there were so many just like rip-offs. Like, there were little parts that were so expensive. Like, I remember, the worst thing I remember is the bolt for a door, like a watertight door on a ship, was $300, and each door had 10 bolts, so that's $3,000 per door, and my second ship had like 1,200 doors. And so it's just an astronomical, for a little bolt, $300 for a little bolt. And so they say, oh, it's mil spec and it's some special kind of like polymer or something like
we're
that.
We're talking $500,000 of bolts?
Just in bolts, yeah. It's crazy.
You're not saying people are actually making money off of this, are you?
Anyway, those were sort of like some of the seeds, I guess, that I kind of kept in the back of my mind, like, this is kind of crap. And also, like, just like the Iraq war I was always against, and I kind of kept my mouth sort of quiet about that while I was in the military, because you're never supposed to,
have an opinion,
talk bad about the chain of command or the commander-in-chief, or yeah, it's just like one of the rules.
Yeah, it's like, General Smedley Butler, Commandant of the Marine Corps, winner of the Congressional Medal of Honor twice, you know, when he got out of the Marine Corps, that's what he said. He's, people in the military spend all the time they're in there, they never think. They just do as they're told, and he didn't have his own thoughts until he got out. And once he did have his own thoughts, he wrote a book called War is a Racket. And I tried getting that on the Commandant's reading list for about a year, and it just didn't work out. I met with so much friction because that book, here you have one of the greatest military leaders of all time who in boot camp you come to idolize because he won the Congressional Medal of Honor twice, but no one wants to tell you that when he got out, he wrote this book called War is a Racket and said that it's the biggest racket. It's internationalized, and the cost of it is in bodies. And he said how terrible and stuff that it was. But you know, a lot of people don't, because they're in there and they have that emotional connection to it, then the only thing that they're going to read and the only thing that they're going to digest mentally is anything that supports the actions that they're doing. Because then if they come to realize that their actions might not be the best thing, and they start getting these other ideas, and you got to handle that. You got to deal with it. So that means getting out and maybe even going back and try to find people that you hurt and say, hey, I killed your father, or I killed your son, or I did this, and you know, how can I help out? But people don't want to deal with that. So they continue on with the lie that what I'm doing is the best and the best thing that I could be doing. I think Noam Chomsky calls it distorted morality. So they distort morality. Morality's perverted into fitting my lifestyle instead of finding a consistent, non-contradictory philosophy that I may have to change my lifestyle. So, but another thought I had on along those lines, there's a book out there called On Killing, and I can't remember the author's name that wrote On Killing, but he's retired military, and he went back and started talking to a lot of veterans about what it took for them to pull a trigger. And there's all these statistics, especially up World War I, World War II, and into Korea, that the people in the trenches wouldn't fire on both sides. Wouldn't fire. They were unwilling to pull triggers, and you had officers and senior enlisted going down the trenches trying to get them to shoot the enemy, and because they hadn't had the proper conditioning long enough, they just refused to shoot. And I can't remember what the statistics were, but they were pretty low. You'd be really surprised on how many people in World War One and World War Two actually were willing to pull
triggers. I think it was like 15% World War One, and then it got up to a little higher World War Two, and then Vietnam was like 90%.
Yeah, it started getting higher because they changed the conditioning techniques. They found that if you put a silhouette target instead of a round target, that people are more likely to shoot somebody if they've been practicing on a silhouette target. You take that silhouette target and you put a face on it, and then people are more likely to shoot. So as you keep making things more real, then people are more likely to do whatever the conditioning is. So it's very an interesting book. I mean, it's nowhere near like some liberty-minded thing, because all through it, the guy is being critical of the military and its actions, but at the same time praising them because he didn't want to offend anybody. So, I mean, if you can get through it and get through that contradiction that's as plain as the nose on my face, it's a good read.
Joseph, when did you encounter Smedley Butler's War as a Racket?
It was around the time I was getting into Ron Paul and all that kind of stuff. But it is pretty amazing to hear this guy. And the question I had for a long time is, where are the Smedley Butlers today? Because you know all the stuff that he complains about, all of the the companies that were in bed with the government getting rich off of this, you know, it's like 10 times worse today. And I was wondering, where are all the Smedley Butlers of today? And I think, this is just my hypothesis, but I think they basically hook them up when they get done. They make sure that the generals and the admirals get really good jobs at these defense contracting companies.
Board of advisors.
Yeah, because one of his main complaint when he first came got out of the military was it had to do with bonuses. I guess all the people in the army or the military at the time during World War I were guaranteed these bonuses. And so when he came out, he was seen as like a leader of all these veterans that I think because of the Depression, they wanted to get the bonus early or something like that. And so they basically led a march on Washington to get this, they call it the Bonus Army. And so maybe if they hooked him up a little better, he may not have been such a troublemaker afterwards.
But
that's just my hypothesis.
Well, they did try. They did want him to lead a fascist coup uprising against FDR. That's another tidbit of information. It's not a conspiracy. There, you can go see Smelly Butler's YouTube video of him on TV talking about that. You know, back in the day. So
you think they're controlling that message, huh, Joey? They definitely don't want your average Marine knowing that the highest decorated Marine. Put it called spade a spade.
Oh, yeah, I think so. I mean, I actually, the Commandant at the time sent me a few emails. Him and I went back and forth, and then he notified me that the Commandant's reading list is not made up by the Commandant. There's some retired generals in Quantico, Virginia that sit and review books, and there's this whole review and process stuff that they have to go through. So then I started contacting those guys, and they I think I got one email back, and that was it. Once they realized what I was trying to do, and then there's like, well, no way. So instead of having a conversation with me, they just ignored me. And they won. They won the war of attrition because I end up stop sending emails to them. You know, maybe I should get with one of these tech guys that could run some sort of spam program and continuously send them my same email over and over until they respond back to me. But it didn't happen.
I think this is a good example of where military indoctrination starts in public education, which. Yeah. I mean public schooling, because to say public education is an oxymoron. But public schooling doesn't, well, let me put it this way. If we had a free market school, then children would learn about Smedley Butler.
Yeah.
And they would learn that about the robber barons were not really robber barons.
Yep.
And that the child labor was in between a choice of children being abandoned and dying of starvation or going to work. That was the choice. So yes, child labor was bad, but it was the lesser of two evils. And public education covers, or public schooling covers that up.
Yeah, and it reminds me of, you know, they would learn that the Pledge of Allegiance or the Bellamy salute looked an awful lot like the High Hitler salute, and that the fact that Bellamy was a National Socialist and wrote the Pledge of Allegiance.
Is that George Bellamy?
Yeah.
Really? Yeah. George Bellamy? Because is he the one that wrote that book? That book about the perfect socialist society.
He had a cousin.
Oh, that was
Well, and both of them were socialists. Mm-hmm. I hear that the one Bellamy that wrote the Pledge of Allegiance also was a flag salesman. So I don't know if that's true or not. However, there was him and his cousin that I think his cousin may have got. The Pledge of Allegiance writer Bellamy into the whole socialist thing. I can't really remember.
Yeah, I remember being forced, because I went to grade school in the 50s and high school in the 60s, and we were forced to recite the Pledge of Allegiance. And at such a young age, you get to be brainwashed to think that this colored piece of cloth has some magical qualities, and you just assume that for the rest of your life.
Yeah, plant the idea.
Yeah,
you
just assume
that
it.
Idea, right?
Sounds like a sacrament to me.
And then and your right. brain is just broken by public schooling. So
right, and then censor.
I've been trying to repair it ever since.
Yeah, then censor out anything that's contradictory, you know, to the initial conditioning that's been implanted in these young kids' minds. You just kind of, if you read the textbooks, even in college textbooks, like take my microeconomics book, for instance, there was two lines on the Austrian School of Economics, and all those two lines mentioned that, Cafe Hayek, that's a Hayek blog that I subscribe to, but that F.A. Hayek actually won the Nobel Prize. That was all it mentioned about the Austrian school. And it's kind of the same thing. Yeah, okay, they'll mention that individuals within the United States government screwed the Indians over royally, but it's just small blurbs in there. But the huge message morphs any type of different opinion that you can have.
Pete, do you think that the flag then is just as important to the government and its faith-based religion as the Shroud of Turin is to Catholicism?
Well, between that and the, you know, one word I've eliminated from my vocabulary is uniform. I refuse to say uniform, except in academic situations like this, but it's a costume. If somebody puts on a costume, then it's okay to murder people, but if you don't have that costume on, it's not okay.
dress for success.
And, if you go by Philip Zimbardo, who's famous for the Zimbardo experiment, which you may probably know as the Stanford Prison Experiment, he's got a book called The Lucifer Effect, and it's a pretty good book on the psychology of people screwing over other people. And going back to the uniform thing that you're talking about, when I was talking about on killing, it reminded me of this too. It said there's studies that have been done, if you go and look at tribal peoples, that if they don't dress up or paint themselves or do any type of body modifications or anything like that, their violence level is down. But the more stuff they start doing, the violence goes up. If they start painting their faces, violence goes up. If they wear masks and completely mask themselves, the violence goes up. And he attributes that to is that they're removing themselves from actually committing, those types of atrocities. So that's what a uniform does. A uniform, you know, makes you look like everyone else, and it takes, okay, well, if all of us look the same, act the same, get paid the same, and are doing the same, then what we're all collectively doing must be okay. And that's why they don't want individuals. That's why that's beaten out of you when you go through your conditioning to go into the military.
And Joey, but since the Marines have by far the snappiest uniforms, do you think that's why they're the most bloodthirsty?
Well, I don't know if there's any statistical evidence to support that, but they do have the snazziest uniforms. I don't care what this former naval officer sitting beside me says.
There's got to be a chapter in that book.
All I did is I just wanted to dress blues because somebody told me I could pick up chicks, and I needed all the help I could get. But anyways.
Oh, so that's why.
It works.
Well, I don't know. I grew up in the 80s, and the Top Gun Choker Whites was always the rage, so that influenced my...
Anybody else got anything? We're getting kind of short on time here.
I guess maybe a question, maybe even for another session, would be, what are some of the things that your teacher never told you? And I'm thinking of one. I think of many, many. But one related to what we're talking about is the fact that the minimum wage laws originated in racism.
Yeah.
The first minimum wage laws were made to keep black people from taking construction jobs.
Got it.
And there's so many parts of government that are based on similar, what I call evil. But maybe that's but just off the top of your head, is there anything or anybody else that, you know, your teacher never told you?
Speaking of laws that were influenced by race, I mean, a handful come to mind. Like, I mean, obviously Separate But Equal was a government law. Also, I've heard that, like, the original government getting involved with marriage had to do with race. And almost always when you hear about the prohibition of alcohol or drugs, a lot of it is race-based fear. I was just listening to an audiobook recently about prohibition. I can't remember the details, but they used race. They said that, like, black people, when they got alcohol in them, got crazy.
And heroin and Chinese, yeah. It's the same thing.
And the same thing with marijuana.
But I think my list of what my teachers didn't tell me is, like, endless. So I think we'll probably have to take that up on a future podcast.
Yeah, do a podcast on the drug war and the things teachers never told you or wanted to lie to you about.
Okay. Jesse?
Well, sorry, I'm a little late for this, but my latest pet peeve is the number 10 of the Communist Manifesto plank, which has public education in there. So I'm wondering if anybody who started public education, whoever that was, got their idea from the Communist Manifesto, or is that just coincidental?
Well, you know, my understanding of it, and I'm not the a historian on the history of public education, but my understanding is that in the United States it came from the German model that was taking place in Germany.
Which came from the Prussian.
Right. So, I mean, we know, of course, that Germany is pretty socialist and was pretty socialist at the time. So I'm sure that there was some basis in that. But, the Industrial Revolution was taking place in Europe and a little later here, a few years later here. And really, public education was established to bring the agricultural workers into the industry so that they'd be able to respond to the working conditions, the bells, the whistles of a workday inside a factory. So that's, to my understanding of it, at least in Germany and the German model that's brought to the United States, that was the big aspect of it. But, I mean, of course, it is all rooted in socialism.
Social control.
Yeah, social control, social engineering.
The Prussian, you know, the Prussians were the so-called mercenaries who fought alongside the British in the United States Revolution. And what one thing my teacher never told me is that the Prussian soldiers were just slaves. They were not mercenaries. They didn't get paid. It was the nobility who owned those slaves, even though they called them serfs, but it's the same thing.
Yeah.
It was nobility who owned those serfs who got paid. And those serfs were raised in a schooling system. It's actually like a boarding school. They made them into machines. And that's basically what our public education system does. It removes creativity, individualism. It creates people that are machines. And the ruling class, for instance, most of the recent presidents attend a different education system, in addition to not serving in the military, and in addition to not worrying about their families ever serving in the military.
I don't know if that answered your question, Jesse, but
it's a whole other issue.
Anyone else?
I have something related to the welfare. I know we're way past that, but
you're keeping it real. You got to bring it back.
Lost my train of thought.
I guess we went too far back.
Well, could have been the beer.
is welfare the other side of the warfare coin? In other words, although technically we don't have a draft right now, the North American tax farm called the United States, but technically we don't have a draft, but there's so many people that join the military to get out of poverty.
Yeah.
Economic draft?
It's an economic draft, yeah.
I think I got it. Individuals will always take the short-term gain over the long-term gain. So if a group of people, like welfare, they take a bunch of money and they steal it from one group and give it to another group, that group that received the money will be better off today, but they don't realize that in the long run that it's hurting them. And it's hard to convince somebody that that welfare that they're receiving is not benefiting them in the long run, that it's going to make them more poor in the future. And I found it really hard to convince somebody that is in that situation, that is taking money from the state,
right,
which is making them better off today, that it's making them poor and everyone else poor in the long
term.
Yeah,
and it's difficult to do that. You know, Stefan Molyneux would call that arguing for the effect. And it is hard to argue for the effect, especially when so many people want to respond to, well, I call it sadistics, they call it statistics, that are out there. But I think, if you're talking to those people, and I don't know, but if you want to strike the root of that problem and have an argument, it's that the money's being taken in the first place. It doesn't matter what the outcome is, if you're better off now or the future. The fact of the matter is one portion of the population is being plundered in order to provide subsistence to another portion. So that portion that receives the subsistence is living at the expense of others. And I think that's the thing that you have to point out and get them to realize, is that you're living at the expense of others. Yeah.
I think part of the root of the problem is the entitlement mentality. I know this woman who was in welfare, and the whole time that she was in welfare, she saw herself as she was getting a loan. In her mind, that was a loan that she had to pay back. She put herself through school, went to medical school, graduated and everything, and of course, her standard of living raised up, and she paid back that money somehow to charities when she went off welfare. But not everybody has that mentality. It's like once they're in welfare, the majority of people, it's get this, I'm entitled to that money.
Right. I don't know if you could hear Patricia or not, but what she was saying was that some people talk themselves into accepting welfare as they look at it and they twist it and they pervert it into saying that I'm receiving a loan and that I'm only going to be on welfare for this short period of time and it's a loan, and then after I get myself out from under the rock and get where I want to be, then I can start finding ways to rationalize how I paid that loan back. And you know, I don't know of anybody that openly sends checks to the state or federal government and said, oh, here, I'm giving you some money back. I don't know anyone that does that. So Patricia was saying that the way that she would do this is by providing to charities and other different things. And all she's really doing is dealing with the guilt. That's what's really happening there. She feels guilty for the theft and the redistribution and for living at the expense of others. So now she's trying to rid herself of that guilt of giving money back. And that's, you know, that's just my opinion on it. I don't know how true it is. But yeah, you're absolutely right, is that a lot of people have to find, not in just this, I mean, this is the whole thing we've been talking about, is people have to find a way to justify their actions instead of saying, maybe I shouldn't be committing these actions in the first place. So, anyone else? Any final words? All right, well, we'd like to thank our hosts, Donna and Jesse at Cafe Libertalia. We'd like to thank Joe for being here. It was a pleasure and an honor, mostly yours. Thanks to the audience, and we hope to see you in the ensuing weeks for this podcast and that we can try to make this a successful thing here. We'd like to thank those listening online at the archive. And I'd also like to encourage everyone to leave feedback on the Facebook page, leave comments, questions, or anything, and kind of let us know where you want us to take this conversation. Because we're here at Ask the Anarchist, we're trying to let the audience and the listeners provide the direction, and us just provide an open forum to where, by no means are we experts on anything, but we're here just to, you know, to let the conversation go on. And Ask the Anarchist podcast is a project of the Libertalia Foundation, whose main purpose is to explore and offer education in the areas of economic thought and social philosophy. For more information, you can visit the foundation at www.libertaliafoundation.org, and that is libertaliafoundation.org. Or if you have a project you would like to have sponsored by the foundation, you can email Jesse Thomas at jthomas@libertaliafoundation.org. And just remember, anarchy is the radical notion that other people are not your property. So quit treating them as such.